you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. As previously reported by CFRC, city staff presented their annual population, housing, and workforce update report to council on July 7th. Included in that report was a comprehensive summary and scope of work for a proposed student housing strategy. The draft proposal stemmed from a February 3, 2026 council directive that cited that the absence of a coordinated student housing framework has contributed to pressures in the broader rental market, including reduced availability of long-term rental housing for families, seniors, and workers. The motion referenced that the City of Kingston has declared a housing emergency and outlined its objectives under its new official plan, which was deferred to June 2027, to guide long-term growth, land use, and housing supply in a coordinated and sustainable manner. The City of Kingston is home to Queen's University, St. Lawrence College, and the Royal Military College, and graduates of these institutions have the potential to contribute valuable skills to the city's labor market. The report argues that without stable and affordable housing options during and after their studies, however, students and recent graduates are more likely to leave the city, hindering the city's capacity to capitalize on the economic return on investment that comes with local employment of graduates, including income growth and long-term population stability. The report argues that student housing is therefore a key factor in the city's ability to retain talent and sustain its workforce. Roughly 34,000 students were enrolled in post-secondary studies in Kingston in 2021, with approximately 96% attending Queen's University and St. Lawrence College. While Stats Canada reported the city's population at that time as 132,485, a study prepared by Watson & Associates Economists Limited in 2023 estimated that 51%, or a full 17,500 of the full-time enrolled students were not captured in the census, downplaying their presence in the city and downplaying the need for housing. Full-time post-secondary student enrollment is forecast to increase to 48,300 by 2051, an increase of 14,300 students. While approximately 1,800 students are anticipated to be accommodated in on-campus housing and 2%, or about 300 students, are anticipated to not require housing in Kingston, the vast majority, 12,200, would require housing, and approximately an additional 5,680 off-campus dwelling units would be needed to accommodate them. The report notes that Royal Military College, RMC, requires all undergraduate students to live on the RMC campus, and the expectation was that student enrollment would remain constant. Student housing pressures are nothing new for the city, with the report citing numerous studies going back to at least the 1990s, seeking ways to address issues from maintaining the character of existing neighborhoods to identifying appropriate areas for intensification to help ease development pressures within the near-campus residential areas. The proposed objectives of the student housing strategy include evaluating the impacts of student housing on the broader housing market and study area neighborhoods, undertaking primary research with students, neighborhood associations, developers, and post-secondary institutions to understand student housing trends, preferences, availability, and challenges applicable to the delivery of purpose-built student accommodations, PBSA, in Kingston. The recommendations will relate to appropriate building heights, density, unit types, parking, amenity area, and other considerations to facilitate feasible and compatible development. Upon consultant selection, it is anticipated that the student housing strategy will take approximately 18 months to complete at an estimated cost of $400,000 plus HST, including consultant and staff time. This cost will be included within the 2027 capital budget, since the contract will not be awarded until after the completion of the official plan in 2027. As reported in the 2021 census, there are a total of 57,835 permanent households in the city of Kingston. Among these, approximately 25,500 households, or 44%, are renters, with multi-unit buildings making up 68% of all rental units. According to the 2025 Rental Market Report, while the national vacancy rate for rental apartments increased to 3.1% in 2025, Kingston's vacancy rate actually declined to 2.4% in 2025, down from 2.9% in 2024. This is despite the fact that over the past 10 years, on average, the city has issued building permits for an average of 958 units per year. The report noted that a vacancy rate around 3% is typically considered to be a healthy balance between supply and demand and is associated with moderate rent growth. Average rents continue to increase for all rental unit types, with the cost of a one-bedroom unit in Kingston, for example, increasing by 24% since 2021. While the city's report claims the average cost of a one-bedroom is roughly $1,500, data from a July 2026 national rental report published by Rentals.ca and Urbanation puts this number at $1,875. The report points out that students unable to access student housing are forced into the general rental market. This creates a supply squeeze, which drives up rent costs and reduces housing stability for lower and moderate income households. It argues that purpose-built student accommodation, PBSA, will be necessary to mitigate demand for market rental apartments and help alleviate pressure on average rents. The City of Kingston has issued a request for proposals from qualified consultants to undertake the student housing strategy following the adoption of the new official plan to establish a policy framework to support the planning and development of PBSA in a manner that advances housing affordability, neighborhood compatibility, infrastructure planning, and long-term growth management. The district supports Mount Williamsville-Sydenham, and the south portion of Kingstown, south of Stephen and River Streets, have been identified as the most likely areas for development of these accommodations, with the student housing strategy study area defined as Portsmouth, near campus, downtown Kingston, Williamsville Corridor, Kingston Center, and Corridor. Nicholas Graham, board member of the Sydenham District Association, appeared before council to speak to residents' concerns in that area and expressed concern over the delayed timeline for the strategy.
Kingston is unique in that the presence of student housing deeply impacts the character of the city centre. Unlike other municipalities, Kingston students represent an enormous percentage of the city's population. According to the report, students account for approximately 25% of the city's inhabitants and a much larger percentage of the city centre. As a first step, the student housing strategy must support effective planning by establishing mechanisms to accurately track the number and location of student residences. Second, the strategy must address the question of how does student housing form part of a complete community? The impact of student housing on central neighbourhoods is enormous and is set to increase. Queen's Professor David Gordon has documented this process in Kingston over the period of 2006-16, showing an inexorable conversion of family neighbourhoods to student neighbourhoods. This impact on the quality of life in the city centre also has an economic impact. An important part of attracting people to Kingston is the beauty and style of life afforded by the city core. And a significant economic driver in the city is the tourism encouraged by our historic centre. Neither of these is enhanced by the continuing conversion of family houses into high-cost and poorly maintained student properties. The strategy is due to be completed by mid-2029, 3 years from now. Work on developing the strategy will start only in quarter one 2028, following a six-month RFP and selection process. Therefore, it will be a full 3 years before we can expect to start implementing a student housing strategy, and likely years beyond that before these changes actually impact our city. During this time, neighborhoods will continue to be eroded, property standards will continue to drop, students will continue to have concerns around safety and affordability, and data will continue not to be collected around where students live and in what numbers. We therefore argue that 3 years is too long for this process, and we cannot afford to wait 1.5 years before starting. We should speed progress through the use of existing materials and by performing tasks now that do not depend on the approval of the new official plan. We're excited that the city has committed to development of a student housing strategy, and we greatly appreciate the efforts of city staff in producing an information report around current process and plans. And we're eager to work with the City Planning Department and with the Post-Secondary Working Group to focus the vision of the report and look forward to discussion on how to speed up the strategy's development.
As mentioned, the student housing strategy will engage with post-secondary institutions, Queen's University, St. Lawrence College, and Royal Military College, with neighborhood associations, and with the private sector, including developers and not-for-profits. It will also consult with its post-secondary working group and other relevant city departments, which may include housing and social services, licensing and enforcement, transportation and transit, Utilities Kingston, and others, to gather background information to ensure that recommendations are contextually appropriate. The final student housing strategy will be presented to the Planning Committee before proceeding to Council for final approval. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is part two of your OUA football season preview, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Today we're looking at the 10th place team from 2025, the York Lions. And though York ultimately did end up finishing in 10th, they were mere inches away from a program-changing upset against the Guelph Griffins in the OUA's regular season finale. That win would have catapulted York back into the playoffs for the first time in 7 seasons. Now, the Lions shocked the Marauders in Week 1 before dropping a surprisingly close contest to the Ottawa GGs in Week 2. York would pick up their second and final win of 2025 against the Varsity Blues in an overtime thriller. Much like their Toronto brethren, it was a crushing loss to Queens that brought the Lions back down to earth, with 57-5 being their worst margin of defeat on the season. York would lose to Western, but their 28 points scored against the Mustang was a new high water mark for the program in the Greg Marshall era. York found themselves in a do-or-die Week 9 game against Guelph, and they would give the Griffins all they could handle before bowing out 34-27. Let's take a look at their 2025 statistics. They were 7th in the conference in points for with 210, averaging about 26.3 per game. They were 1st in the OUA in passing yards with 2,758, averaging about 344 passing yards per game. Very impressive. York finished 8th in rushing yards with 870, 5th in total yards with 3,495, putting up about 453 yards per game. Really strong offensive numbers for the Lions, especially compared to how anemic their offense was over the last 5 seasons or so. Unfortunately for the Lions, their defense, which I thought was their unquestioned strong point in 2024, was a major weakness in 2025 as they finished last in points allowed with 327, which is just a shade under 41 points per game. They were 10th in pass defense, allowing 365 yards per game, 11th in rush defense, allowing 190 yards per game, and 10th in overall total yards allowed per game. They really struggled on defense in 2025. Their point differential of minus 117 was 10th in the conference. Over the last 5 seasons, it hasn't really been pretty for York. 0-6 in 2021, 1-7 in 2022, but bear in mind, their only win, which was actually a loss to McMaster, was a forfeit win due to McMaster's use of an ineligible player. They finished 0-8 in 2023, and 2023 was unquestionably rock bottom for the program, one of the worst college football teams I have ever seen. I want to say they gave up something like 550 points in 8 games. Queens beat them by 87, just to give you an idea of where that team was at. They hire a new head coach, they have a new culture in place, and they pick up 2 wins in 2024. Feel good team. They pick up 2 wins in 2025, and I think they looked better overall, but you're in a pretty scary point now where if you're an underdog, you can only be an underdog for so long. Eventually, your dog's got to start barking, you know, and 2026 looks like it's going to be a tough year for the Lions. They've lost a couple of key stalwarts from the dark days, like Avante McCoy and Melchus Ilunga. They're losing their great linebacker, Peyton Ryder. They're losing their quarterback, Sean Lall and Keegan Hall. They do use a very transfer-heavy recruiting approach, so it's likely that they're going to get some game-ready talent in, but they need to start solidifying a high school recruiting pipeline if they want long-term success. I love the new culture in place at York. I think it's a team on the up, but look, you can only be an underdog for so long, folks. You can only be an underdog for so long, and I think there's going to be more expectations on York, especially with some of the struggles that their crosstown rivals have had. this needs to be a step up or step off kind of year for the program, in my opinion. Looking at their 2026 schedule, I think there are four games that are feasibly winnable for York, those being Carleton in week one, McMaster in week three, Toronto in week eight, and Waterloo in week nine. I think York will learn some hard lessons early in the season before rebounding to win against Toronto, and that is the only game I think I favor the Lions in, but it's worth noting that three wins feels like this team's ceiling, and I think one is its floor. I don't see them going 0-8, but I don't see them making the playoffs either. Ultimately, I've got York with a 1-7 record, good enough for 10th place in the OUA, just ahead of their crosstown rival, the Toronto Varsity Blues. Coming up next, we have your City of Kingston traffic report for the week and your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. This is your City of Kingston traffic report. Cranbrook Street from Lakeview Avenue to Days Road is closed for pedestrian improvements. Baggett Street from Barrie to West Street is closed for the Eastern Canadian Little League Championship. Bath Road from Sir John A to Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing intersection pedestrian signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. Wright Crescent at Palace Road to Palace Road is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. Norman Rogers Drive from Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard to Van Order Drive started on June 15th. Norman Rogers Drive is closed to through traffic to facilitate roadway rehabilitation and configuration improvements. This work will improve road condition, accessibility, and safety for all road users, including students, families, and local residents. Reminder that the City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston are in the midst of a reconstruction of Princess Street. This major infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrians and cyclists. Barrie Street to Queen Street is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is still closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, July 20th, 24 degrees with hazy sun in the forecast, so more wildfire smoke coming your way this week. Tuesday, July 21st, 23 degrees, cloudy, windy, humid with a high likelihood of a thunderstorm, 88% chance to be exact. Very stormy day in the city of Kingston. Wednesday, July 22nd, we've got some fallout from those stormy conditions. 55% chance of rain in the forecast. Mostly cloudy, a bit of a breeze, a little bit cooler thanks to all the rain, dropping down to 15 overnight. Thursday, July 23rd, 23 is your high with a few morning showers in the forecast, otherwise quite sunny throughout the day. Friday, July 24th, a high of 24, partly sunny with some afternoon showers, about a 60% chance of rain in the afternoon. Saturday, July 25th, 24 degrees is your high with a 59% chance of rain. And then ending out the weekend, Sunday, July 26th, another 24 degree day with a mix of sun and cloud and a 58% chance of precipitation. That's a wrap for traffic and weather. Coming up next, we have Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, workshops, markets, or family-friendly activities, there is plenty happening in Kingston this week, so let's get into it. Starting off Monday, Café Franglais returns over lunch on Sydenham Street, followed by Craft and Create at the Central Branch Library in the evening. Live music includes Jazz Mondays with Michael K. Myers and Rick Flanagan at the RCHA Club, Nolan Habarb's Monday Musical Residency at the Coven, and the Mourning Doves at Musiki Café. Tuesday features a mix of creative and community programming, including chair fitness and an ASL workshop on Sydenham Street, as well as an all-you-can-eat pasta night at the Italo-Canadian Club, and salsa in the square returning to Springer Market Square. Music highlights include Souls of Mischief at the Broom Factory, Tom Savage's Tuesday Happy Hour Jam at the RCHA Club, Eric Urin and Megan Below at the Cove Inn, Quirks of Human Nature with Meg Freer and Deborah Schrumans at Time Out Bar, and Open Mic at Musiki. Wednesday offers plenty to do, beginning with silent reading on Sydenham Street before Games in the Square and the Swinging Summer Concert Series Takeover Downtown in the evening. This week also features a free Movies in the Square screening of But I'm a Cheerleader. Music fans can watch Taryn McKenna and Vince DeBeal at the Belvedere Hotel, Sean McCullen at the Cove Inn, Fiverr at Many Moons Events, and Luella as part of the Sound Waves Concert Series at Spicer's Dockside Grill, and of course, an open mic at Time Out Bar. Thursday features the Kingston Public Market, a community picnic at Cultivate Arts Commons, a Princess Monaco film screening at Robert Sutherland Hall, and the Story Stitched in Fabric workshop at the Tet Center. Another Movies in Square screening following the School of Rock. Live music includes Rob Moore at the Cove Inn, Pete's Wolf Island Records musical review at Hotel Wolf Island, Sam Coons and Ryan Gallagly at the RCHA Club, Battle of the Bands, Punk vs. Metal at Daft Brewing, Spaced, Terminator and Anchor Lines at the Broom Factory, and the National Youth Orchestra of Canada at the Isabel Bader Center. Friday is packed with entertainment. The off-season dance festival gets underway at Hotel Wolf Island, while Kicking It Country returns to the City Hall Amphitheater. Music highlights include River City Junction at the Cove Inn, the Celtic Kitchen Party as part of the Waterfront Concert Series, Tyler Brett Forks at Mayor's Creek Brewing Company, Marion Dexler Band at the RCHA Club, Mellow Lily at the Turninog, and the Astros at the Toucan. Heading into Saturday, you can browse the Kingston Public Market, catch Chef Dimanche at City Hall Amphitheater, enjoy Saturday sessions in Confederation Park, or take part in Vibrant Voices, a song circle for the 2S LGBTQIA+ at the Central Library. The off-season dance festival continues on Wolf Island. Live music includes Matt Dixon at the Cove Inn, Andrew Mack Band at Spicer's Dockside, Outskirts as part of the Waterfront Concert Series, and the Howe Island Rockin' the Rock 2026. Wrapping things up Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market returns alongside the Cataraqui Indigenous Market in Confederation Park, as well as Yoga and Battery Park. Music includes Gerald McGrath at Finkel's Shore Park, Smellowship and Midnight Magic Rodeo Show at Hotel Wolf Island, Spencer Evans at Time Out Bar, Head Over Heels at the Cove Inn, Princess Towers with Efren Strange and Emily Steele at Hotel Wolf Island, and live band karaoke with the Oreos at the Merchant Tap House. That's your weekly events and concerts calendar for July 20th through the 26th. For more information on any of these events, visit CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. The events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their upcoming shows and events throughout the season. I'm Jenny. Thanks for listening and have a great week, Kingston.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present The Dark Maths, the second EP from Kingston-based band Gifts of Guilt, an indie rock supergroup featuring members of several local bands. The release draws inspiration from the distinctive sounds of bands such as Pavement, Slint, and The Breeders. Be sure to follow at Gifts of Guilt on Instagram to stay up with the latest band news. Are you a local musician who'd like airplay and social media coverage on CFRC's channels? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Dark Maths on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Gifts, here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Cancer is the number two killer of all cancers. It can affect anyone. But with early detection, the survival rate is estimated at 90%. The key? A simple test you do in your own home.
I'm Ann Murray, and I lost a very dear friend to colon cancer. He was 49, and had he been tested, he might still be with us. Talk to your doctor. Get your test. Not knowing is not the answer.
For more information or to donate, visit coloncancercanada.ca. Colon Cancer Canada. We're behind, you're behind.
Have you ever been to Extended Family Kingston?
Stop by and visit our programs and talk to our staff to find out how our staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
and my friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love Extended Family.
Visit us at www.efkingston.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to extended family. Come and have some fun.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 226. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Sam Gould, who is an educator, artist, and community organizer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This conversation is really focused on hearing Sam's experiences and the communities that he is connected to in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and particularly around the mobilizations to support those facing the violence of the Trump administration's ICE raids around a region of the city called Powderhorn Park. Sam speaks about the ways that community organizing has played an important role in the response to ICE raids in different cities across the United States. Of course, Minneapolis was key to really pushing back against this violent attack on migrant communities on the part of the American government. And so I thought it would be really meaningful to get a firsthand account of a community organizer with long roots in an important region of Minneapolis, and to really just describe what community organizers have been doing, both on the streets, but also the mutual aid networks that have emerged to support those facing the violence of the ICE crackdowns in Minneapolis, but also across the United States. This type of organizing process, although different in each community, is mirrored in certain ways through grassroots organizing. So on this edition of Free City Radio, I'm sharing with you my conversation with Sam Gould in Minneapolis. Here it is. Sam, the images that you've shared from Minneapolis in the last week in your network of community organizers and artists and activists have been pretty harrowing. We were talking in early February 2026, and I really got a sense of the sort of physical emergency that a lot of people are facing around these ICE raids in Minneapolis. So I want to talk to you about that, but also just sort of zooming out, you know, you're one of many people that has chosen to sort of be present on the streets at a certain level to sort of be with people and to try to encounter this very violent situation. Of course, it's not just Minneapolis, but many cities around the United States right now where immigrant and migrant communities are being targeted. So zooming out, maybe you could just introduce yourself a bit. I understand you're a community worker and artist. You have a family there in Minneapolis, and you've sort of taken that leap to be part of the grassroots response of residents of Minneapolis who are both documenting and protesting these ICE raids. So it'd be great to hear about who you are and then any sort of initial reflections about what you've seen and your experiences.
Yeah, I think just to put this point out very early, I think for the majority of Minneapolitans, it's not necessarily a choice. This situation is unavoidable. You can attempt to avoid it and you'll still, encounter it. So it's not really a matter of people thinking, oh, do I want to get involved in this? It's really more, can I get away from this if that is your predilection. It's omnipresent. In my neighborhood in particular, I live in South Minneapolis in a neighborhood called Powderhorn Park, which is named after our park, Powderhorn, which is a block from my house. My area of Minneapolis is contiguous to East Lake Street, which is a main artery that runs through South Minneapolis across the Mississippi River into St. Paul. And it's historically, you know, at least for the last 100 years or so, really been a place of entanglement and beginnings for large groups of people, people coming from many different experiences, cultures, races, economic classes. There's two wonderful books by a neighbor who grew up here in the 30s and 40s, Nelson Peary, who was a black communist who lived just about a quarter of a mile south of my house, closer to George Floyd Square, where George Floyd was murdered. And he, in his first memoir, Black Fire, talks about going to South High School. This is where my kids go. And there's just a snippet of him talking about in the 1930s going to South. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, he could be talking about my kids' experience. You know, some of the cultures have changed, but those sorts of entanglements and energy and friction and sense of this is our place in a very polyglot, heterogeneous way rhymed nearly 100 years later. So that's kind of a sense of our neighborhood. And I would argue one of the reasons, really maybe the main reason Trump and his minions have zeroed in on this place, our home, because it represents a future America that they're desperately attempting to stop in some way. We are a living metaphor of a polyglot United States that is inevitable, and it's anathema to them. It strikes as such an insult to their kind of Protestant Christian whiteness, which is not at all what this neighborhood is. This neighborhood is all different cultures, and well, not everyone obviously, but just many different cultures, many different races, different sexual orientations, and it's very open and critical and questioning and creative. It's one of the reasons where when I arrived here, my wife grew up in Minneapolis, not far from where we live. I'm from New York City originally. When we moved here, this really was the only place I could think of living. I felt welcomed here. It felt like home. It felt like what I think not just a city is supposed to be, what a neighborhood is supposed to be. Yeah. So, I mean, that's where, in the big picture, that's where we're at. And then within this also, you know, I'm an artist and editor. I'm a professor at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. As a space for artists and culture workers in general of all stripes, I love how cultural work really embeds itself within the life of the neighborhood, not as an offshoot, but as part of its ecology, as something that is vital for the energy of this place. It is not seen as secondary in any way, or even objective. Like, it is a subjective force.
It's really meaningful to sort of have a sense of this district. Powderhorn Park is the park, but Powderhorn area in Minneapolis. Thank you for sharing that, Sam. And also I think that the distinction you shared in terms of thinking about the raids on the part of ICE as being a reality that's unavoidable is really kind of something to underline from what you shared. So thank you for putting that forth. Maybe could you talk a little bit about some of these grassroots actions that have been taking place? Because obviously, yes, people are encountering this reality in terms of, you know, ICE agents showing up in different restaurants or parks or contexts or school pickup, drop-off, daycare, pickup, drop-off. But there's also clearly an attempt of citizens to come together to document these raids and to be present. So I'd love to just get a sense of what that's been like for you and your experience.
Well, I mean, my last, like, kind of harrowing experience, rather than just, like, the consistent slow creep of dread that it's been, was, you know, Tuesday was, I believe, the fourth morning in a row where I was woken up by not just the impulse, but just like this reality of having to run out of my house because ICE was present. On Tuesday, once again, they were circling our block. Really, it seemed kind of to antagonize, almost like a shark would circle prey. They just kept going around, and my family and I were woken up to car horns and whistles, and I ran outside. Two of my kids ran outside, and this car just keeps circling. And then, you know, they have no idea where they are. So he drove down a dead-end alley, and a car followed, and a bunch of neighbors followed. And he stuck at the end of an alley. We're all closed in on one another. So then, you know, three ICE agents in tactical gear and helmets come out with their weapons drawn as all of these neighbors are in a standoff with these nonviolent neighbors with no weapons and three armed federal agents pointing guns at us. And we slowly have to figure out how we're not going to run in fear, but we're also not going to get ourselves shot. And my, you know, two of my kids are with me in this situation where I'm then having to think, oh, you know, what do I do here? Where I make sure that, like, my children are safe too, but my children also feel compelled to protect their neighborhood, protect their neighbors in the only way that any of us can think of, which is to be present, to put ourselves in between this vile force and both literally and metaphorically what they represent. I'd like to say that occurrence has been an anomaly, and I'm kind of shocked by that. That's one of so many different, very similar occurrences that have happened over the last 2 months. But there is a real kind of impulse by everyone to just say, I will not stand idly by this. There are people running out of their homes at every moment. There are people standing on street corners on watch. There are people driving around the neighborhood in a very organized but organically formed manner, wherein we're all talking to one another and patrolling the neighborhood, keeping our eyes on ICE almost 24 hours a day. And this is tens and tens of thousands of people. Along with this, incredible mutual aid efforts. I would argue all of this is mutual aid, but in terms of, like, practical goods, helping people with rent assistance. My neighborhood, like many other neighborhoods, has started rent assistance funds, wherein we've gotten plenty of other people to donate. As of today, just my neighborhood has been able to raise over $360,000 for neighbors who cannot leave their homes, so we can pay their rent for them. A good friend of mine who teaches at Carleton College, lives in St. Paul, he started off protecting a daycare center down the street from his house. Then it turned out after one of the teachers was abducted, he now drives the teachers to and from work every day. None of these stories are unusual to anyone here on the ground right now. It's just what we're doing.
There's a really important point, I feel, that sort of comes out of what you're describing, which is just to sort of underline a pretty critical idea that popular action can change conversations, right? Like, I think there's a sense that, you know, certain policies are inevitable or certain outcomes inevitable. If we're talking about mainstream media narratives, of course there's important alternatives in the United States, like Democracy Now! And others. But, you know, it's just sort of, I think, interesting to always underline the sort of role that community action can play in changing dynamics. And thinking about that also, because at least here in the Canadian context, we hear from, you know, let's say press clippings where we'll hear like a short statement from the governor of Minnesota or maybe the mayor of Minneapolis. But it's very rare that we hear out from individuals outside of people who've been extremely victimized, or, you know, a family member of, you know, somebody who's been detained, which is also important. But we don't hear many voices of people who are kind of there on a grassroots level changing the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important to share those stories. Also because I think this is a global issue. This is an issue of, you know, if we can be technical here, of kind of ever creeping hegemony that is going all over the world of a very small amount of people governing a huge populace, whether that's the US or Canada, or simply just like the loss of any notion of nation states. And it is purely just kind of the you know, kind of the technocrats and capitalists running everything. So this is, in sharing those stories outwards, I hope what it can provide is not simply inspiration, but also some tools for how to adapt our experiences on the ground in other social landscapes. Because even in the US, what we're doing here in Minneapolis, for a variety of different reasons, both culture, literally urban design, the geography of space, that's not necessarily going to work in the same way that it will work in Dallas. What we're doing here in Minneapolis is very different than what good friends of mine had been doing in Chicago, or what has been happening in Los Angeles. We all need to respond to our own social landscapes and their particularities. We are doing that here in a way that is very unique to us. It makes a lot of sense to both the geography of this place and the culture of this place, and specifically in the neighborhood here in South Minneapolis, in the neighborhoods that are closest to East Lake Street. This is generational work. There is a muscle memory, a kind of critical continuum that, like I said at the beginning of when we were talking, goes almost all the way back 100 years. You can read Nelson Peary's books about this kind of collective education and collective experience across cultures, across races, and across time. It should never be forgotten that the American Indian Movement was founded in this neighborhood in response to the abuse of the Minneapolis Police Department. This neighborhood was up in flames 5.5 years ago because of the abuse of the Minneapolis Police Department. 5.5 years later, we now have federal agents who are treating this neighborhood in very much the same way it has been treated for a century. So with that, there is a type of grassroots knowledge that is intuitive, that is shared by people here. And as I said earlier, that also is, that's cultural work in terms of a critical faculty of how you look out for one another, what your values are, but it is also cultural work in that creativity and having kind of cross-cultural connections that buoy one another and lift one another up are a form of how we see one another. These are tools of recognition, and they are tools of shared support.
It's, I think, important to talk about also the idea of infrastructure. There's a cultural and social infrastructure which you're describing, and we're sort of coming, I think, to this moment where a lot of people in sort of progressive community networks are thinking about what does infrastructure look like, because these informal networks have been really capable of responding to crisis moments. But, you know, it's been really challenging to think about beyond the crisis. You know, there's, of course, always examples of numerous projects, particularly in the arts. So maybe this could be a twofold kind of response. I'd love to hear your thoughts about infrastructure. And then also if there's any sort of interesting cultural initiatives or projects or arts-based expressions that you think are important for people to resonate with this, with in this moment.
The majority of the work that I do is artwork that I do is that. It has been for, you know, 25 years. But when a few years after moving to Minneapolis, you know, I had kind of jumped around on the contemporary art bandwagon for a while, and have for like the last two decades, since like 2000 or so, have done what became known as social practice artwork. But as I said, like about 4 years after moving here, I just realized, like, you know, I'm hopping to all of these different neighborhoods, these different communities, these different cities all over the world. And all of the things that I'm concerned about are happening where I live. And where is the reciprocity in how I'm operating? So I gave myself this kind of framework of doing the majority of my work within walking distance of my house, arbitrarily for a 10-year period. It's been like 11 years now. Really what it was, to get to your point, was that a lot of it is how we can create and bolster and steward social infrastructures outside of a culture of crisis. That it's so much our nature to respond to crisis, which is a highly manipulative force. But the way that we respond to crisis, which is inevitable, and like you need to respond in some way, is evidenced by what you're seeing in Minneapolis right now, which is, how do we relate to one another? How do we work with one another? How do we celebrate with one another? How do we learn from one another outside of spaces of crisis? And again, like I've said, this neighborhood is a perfect example of that, of people experimenting in different ways for us to figure out how to live with one another. And by living with one another, I really mean like stewarding a community of care. That is not to say that it is perfect. There's plenty of strife. There's plenty of argument, but that's human. That's fine. And it's one of the things that kind of makes me laugh when there are critiques of what's going on in Minneapolis right now and the inevitable accusation of, like, who's funding these people? How did this just occur out of nowhere? This is obviously a highly organized and well-financed campaign against the federal government. It's like, no, this is the culture of this place. Like, this is what we know. And it's because we do this work outside of the manufactured crises that power implements to manipulate us. And this is a highly manipulative historical moment.
Sam, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts today from Minneapolis.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Sam Gould,
community organizer, artist, and educator based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, speaking about the community mobilizations against the attacks on migrant communities that have been happening in the context of the ICE raids. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. We're also a podcast. Just look us up. Search Free City Radio. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week. Take care.
Tune in Sundays at 8 p.m. right here on CFRC 101.9 FM for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared, bringing you the best new and vintage new wave, punk, post-punk, indie pop, and electronica every single week. Your new and old favorite songs are coming in hot.
No static. No static. No static. No static.